Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Domestic violence is increasing because of COVID-19 all around the world.
Think about it. Being forced not to leave the home, having no access to community, having no access to family. For a perpetrator, this is a perfect set of conditions.
What we know about the rising rates of intimate partner violence and who's doing the work to make things better. I'm Tanzina Vega, and that's first up today on The Takeaway for Tuesday, December 1st, 2020. Then we continue on domestic violence with the next part in our series, Justice Delayed, asking how the pandemic has affected U.S. courts and what delayed cases mean for survivors of violence in the home. Also on the show, the NFL forges ahead even as multiple teams deal with COVID-19 cases. And then for many people, pets have been a lifeline during the pandemic, preparing for post-pandemic life for our pets.
My cat Benjamin is a lovable and affectionate little fella. I love this little critter now more than ever.
But first... Activists around the world rallied last Wednesday as part of the International Day for Elimination of Violence Against Women. The day was meant to call attention to the so-called shadow pandemic of violence against women and girls that emerged as countries were forced to lock down because of COVID-19, trapping many at home with their abusers. According to the United Nations, domestic violence has intensified in the months since the pandemic first began. In some places, calls to helplines have increased fivefold. In others, shelters are at capacity. But before COVID-19, global domestic violence had already reached epidemic proportions. Last year alone, 243 million women and girls worldwide were subjected to physical or sexual violence. Today, we look at what international governments are doing to address the rise in domestic violence during the pandemic and how that's playing out here at home. I'm joined now by Anita Bhatia, the Deputy Executive Director at UN Women. Anita, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure, Tanzina. Hello there.
How do we define the spectrum of abuse that in terms of domestic or intimate partner violence?
Well, it ranges from what you can easily imagine in, which is physical violence and the attacking of a woman's body by an intimate partner, to more subtle forms of violence, including psychological violence. And of course, women are also preyed upon by unknown predators through cyber violence.
Who is most at risk right now? Are we talking mostly about women and girls? Are we talking about LGBTQ people or people from other marginalized communities?
I think there are risks in all communities, but I really do want to underscore the risks right now to women and girls, because the conditions that we are facing with renewed lockdowns are the very conditions that actually help perpetrators of violence. And that's why the Secretary General of the UN called for a ceasefire at home, because home is the place where women are the least safe.
Tell us about some of the examples that you're seeing of how this pandemic has made domestic violence worse for women because of either full lockdowns, shelter-in-place orders, or even just the idea that we can't be in community with others. You know, here in the United States, we're not in a full lockdown, but we're definitely more separated from others than we would normally be.
You're absolutely right. And what happened at the beginning of the pandemic was that the shelter helplines across the world, not just in the U.S., phones were ringing off the hook, because the numbers of violence were going up so starkly everywhere. UN Women was collecting data because we have, you know, pretty deep connections to women's rights groups on the ground in pretty much every country in the world. And what we were hearing was really staggering. So I think the shape that this violence has taken over the last 9 months has been to bring out into the open something that had already existed and we knew that it was there, but it just became so much more visible in some ways during the pandemic because of the crisis situation that so many shelters and helplines found themselves in.
I'm wondering if we can even talk a little bit about what some of these environments are like that are leading to this. Is part of it because these are relationships that are already, marked by domestic violence and being kept away from friends and families and isolated only exacerbates that? Or is it also, Anita, the fact that many folks are being forced to not just work from home, but take care of their children from home and sort of create this a pressure cooker of an environment, if you will, that many people are in? Or is it all of the above that's leading to these increased cases of domestic violence?
I think the phrase that you used, pressure cooker, is right, because of course some of these cases were cases where abuse was a feature of family life even before the pandemic. But the stress of being in lockdown and the perfect conditions for abuse that the pandemic created, I mean, think about it. Being forced not to leave the home, having no access to community, having no access to family, for a perpetrator, this is a perfect set of conditions. So some of it, of course, was the repeat of what would have been a historic pattern in that family setting. But some of it is new, brought on by the stresses of not having work and by the pressure cooker effect of just having to be at home all the time.
Are there particular countries or regions where we're hearing more reports of domestic violence during the pandemic, Anita?
I wish I could tell you that there were some countries where this wasn't happening, but our data actually shows that this has been a pretty universal trend. And one of the things that the pandemic has done is that it has enabled people to talk about this in a way that just wasn't possible before the pandemic. In fact, it has forced governments to talk about this in a way that hadn't been done before because it became such a big issue. So we've had countries like France where the government had to come out and rent 20,000 hotel rooms to give shelter to victims of violence who had to escape home. We've had countries where the government had to come up with secret codes that women could go and use, for example, at a local pharmacy to signal that they needed help. So governments have had to come out and speak about this, whereas previously, you know, a lot of issues on violence against women were treated as just family issues that had to be sorted out at the family level or perhaps at the community level, but not a matter of government public policy. And what the pandemic has done is that it has made this an issue of government public policy. And that's why the Secretary General of the UN asked for a number of countries to join with him in calling for a ceasefire at home and in recognizing this as a shadow pandemic.
I have a flip side question for you. I'm wondering, as we're seeing the rise of authoritarian governments in certain parts of the world, some might even argue here in the United States under Donald Trump, but even in Brazil with Jair Bolsonaro and others, is there any connection, Anita, between the rise of authoritarian governments led particularly by men to these increasing cases of domestic violence? Do we know if there's a connection there?
You know, what I would say is that governments which have authoritarian leaders and authoritarian countries which have authoritarian governments are definitely seeing a violation of human rights more broadly. And human rights defenders are finding it increasingly hard to make themselves heard without being subjected to some form of persecution. So there is definitely a link, and we know that for certain marginalized communities, you had talked about LGBTQI initially, that life is definitely harder. Now, when it comes to the data on violence against women, we see that even in countries which don't have authoritarian governments. So the sad thing about the issue of violence against women is actually its universality.
What else can governments do at this point? And are they having to step in? Because here, for example, in the United States, the legal system is so backed up because of the coronavirus, because there are caseloads. Even though domestic violence is prioritized, there's still a lag. Are governments having to step in because the judicial systems in these countries, in so many countries, are backed up as they are here in the United States?
I think the judicial system, in any case, is not going to be the place of first resort for a woman who's being beaten. And so you're absolutely right that governments have had to step in, and there are many different ways in which they can do it. So, for example, certain provinces in Canada declared, even at the height of the pandemic, when most things were closed, that shelters were essential services and had to remain open. So that's a simple thing that all governments can do as we enter the next phase of lockdown, is to make sure that shelters are declared essential services and are kept open. So that's number one. A second thing, of course, that governments can do is to make sure that funding continues to go to community shelters and to hotlines that women can call for help. And I would say there's also a role for business and for individuals to make sure that these services remain open no matter what's going on in terms of the lockdown.
The holidays are upon us. They are very different this year. Many people are having them largely in small groups, if at all, and many people are having them in isolation. We know that holidays can also be a difficult time, and there are often an increase in domestic violence cases around holidays. Anita, for people who are listening, who find themselves in an abusive situation or know people who are or could be, what should they do given what we've been talking about, particularly now that we're combining a difficult holiday season with a global pandemic?
Yes, for women who find themselves in these awful situations, the first thing I would say is please have the courage to seek help. Help is available, and it must be sought. For governments, for city governments, for municipalities, I would say please make sure that your police forces are sensitized and know that this is an important issue which has to be paid attention to, because very often women will call and police hotlines or emergency lines will simply not pay enough attention to the phone call. So we need to make sure that the police are a force for good and are sensitized through training and through awareness building that this is a really important issue. And if you're an individual, just think about what signs you might be seeing of unusual behavior that might lead you to pause and think, is there something going on here where I can be helpful?
Are there specific things people should look for?
I think anything which looks like an unusual pattern, which of course is difficult to detect right now because so many things are unusual, but anything that looks off the charts. And of course, if you know somebody where there is a history of violence, be extra vigilant. Make sure you're making time for that extra check-in. Make sure that they're okay. Very often, victims of violence will try to justify, because of psychological oppression, their current situation. So they will often downplay the risks that they and their children may be facing. And I would say if you have somebody in your family or your community who is like that, make sure that you are reaching out to them and making sure that they are okay.
Anita Bhatia is the Deputy Executive Director at UN Women. Anita, thanks so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, Tanzina.
If you or someone you know is experiencing domestic violence, you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-SAFE. That's 1-800-799-7233 for support in English and Spanish. In our series, Justice Delayed, we've been talking about how the pandemic has led to a backlog of court cases of all kinds. Some states shuttered courts altogether for a time. Others opened them with specific kinds of cases taking priority. And others are only conducting proceedings virtually. And that changing court landscape means more and more victims of intimate partner violence may be facing delays in their cases and struggling to receive or even reach out for the resources they need. So picking up on our series, Justice Delayed, we have Margot Lindauer, the director of the Domestic Violence Institute at Northeastern University School of Law. Margot, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
What types of intimate partner violence are we seeing nationally right now?
Well, we're seeing similar types of intimate partner violence that we always see. We're just seeing an increase in numbers and severity with a decrease in services. So we see intimate partner violence between intimate partners or romantic partners. We see violence in the home between family members. We see violence in the home between roommates and housemates as well.
We talked a little bit about this on a global scale in the last segment, but what's really driving this? Is it the pressure cooker environment that a lot of us are in because we're home more and we're isolated more from other folks?
I think it's multiple factors. I don't think we can pick just one. I think the isolation of the pandemic certainly has exacerbated rates and risks of intimate partner violence. We see the economic impact of the pandemic, particularly on communities that are vulnerable, exacerbating intimate partner violence, housing instability, exacerbating intimate partner violence, the challenge of many, many schools being closed and students going online, also exacerbating stress and intimate violence in the home.
What did the intimate partner violence landscape look like in terms of getting help before the pandemic?
That's a really good question because it was never enough. The service availability prior to the pandemic in the United States in March, we always saw more demand than supply. And what I mean by that is there were always more individuals seeking shelter than there were shelter beds available. There were always more individuals seeking legal service help than there were legal services available. There were always more individuals seeking domestic violence services in general, housing services in general. But what we've seen with the pandemic is that the demand has increased and the supply of services has decreased dramatically. So many folks who may need help and may want help are not getting the help that they need.
I understand what's led to the increase in need, but what's led to the decrease in supply?
So one of the things that we're experiencing is that as many organizations and institutions have moved their operations to online or to virtual intervention or virtual services rather, that might not work for the population we're serving. So that's twofold, right? Maybe an individual who's seeking services cannot or does not have access to the technology required to meet with a case manager or a lawyer virtually. That's one. The other is that virtual engagement might be convenient for some people in that you don't have to leave your home, of course, but it might be unsafe for a victim who is living or in close proximity to their abuser. The other thing we're seeing, at least in Boston, is that some hearings, particularly restraining order or intimate partner violence, civil restraining orders, many courts are requiring individuals to appear in person for those hearings. And what we're seeing also is that many of those individuals prior to the pandemic may have been eligible for pro bono representation through a variety of different resources. But many individuals, many lawyers, and many firms and many organizations are not allowing their attorneys to go in person. So even if there wasn't enough attorneys prior to the pandemic to do pro bono or low bono representation, there are even fewer attorneys available now. That's just one example.
Let's talk about, so beyond the lack of attorneys that are available, what about the courts themselves? I mean, I've had to handle some basic things, what I thought were basic things in court, and even the folks there have said to me, look, we are backed up. Like anything that you've got to handle is going to take longer than normal. So are there also delays in terms of reporting, filing, for example, restraining orders or orders of protection?
Yeah, so there are absolutely significant delays in the court system. What I will say is that many courts are prioritizing restraining orders, civil restraining orders, as they are emergency in nature. But I will also say that many criminal cases that involve domestic violence have been pushed back and have experienced incredible delays. So many of the cases where an individual might have a civil restraining order against their abuser, they may also be a victim in a criminal case. And those cases have experienced incredible delays. Courts are operating on a skeletal staff. They are operating in some form of hybrid in-person and remote operation. Most courts, as far as I know, are not seating any juries or doing any jury trials. So many of the criminal cases involving intimate partner violence have experienced incredible backlogs.
We've read stories about, particularly in the New York Law Journal, about how lawyers were, some of them at the peak of the pandemic, were trying to communicate with their clients from parking lots and random places, just scrambling to try and help these folks. Have you heard from lawyers as well who are really doing everything that they can to try and ameliorate some of the issues that these intimate partner violence victims are experiencing?
Yes, I would say that advocates in general, not just lawyers, many are going, you know, using their clients' experiences and their clients' stories and what is safe for their clients to meet them where they are, if that is safe. What I will say is that many advocates, case managers, lawyers are confronting challenges with kind of organizational protocol about in-person case management and advocacy. So there's some tension there.
Is it that advocates are trying to physically meet with their clients and aren't able to do that because of the pandemic?
Yes, I would say that there is certainly a real challenge of meeting in person for certain advocates. Certain organizations aren't allowing it. Certain advocates cannot because of pre-existing conditions of their own or family members. And so it is really challenging to meet in person, and vice versa for victims as well. It might not be safe for them to meet in person, or they may not be able to leave their homes.
What about the effect that all of this is having if the couple has children, on the children, the stresses or mental health effects on families that are having to go through this system during the pandemic?
Absolutely. The impact on children is severe. It always is severe. But what we see kind of in pre-pandemic times is that schools often are a positive source of intervention and services for many children who are witnessing domestic violence and experiencing the impacts of domestic violence. We're also seeing, of course, that the stress of remote education kind of has its own mental health impact on children. So for a child living in a home where they're exposed to violence and experiencing the pandemic and the isolation associated with not being in school, the impact is severe.
Margot, we want to offer some hope to people who may be listening to this and who may be in an intimate partner violence situation that they feel trapped in. What are some real steps that someone in that situation can take right now?
Yes. So what I would say is help and advocacy looks different for different people. So while there have always been, I mean, for the last 40 or so years, kind of traditional domestic violence agencies and hotlines that are available and are a wonderful resource, many individuals might not feel comfortable going to those resources for help. And so what I would say is that encouraging people to identify and look for positive sources of help, either within their communities, within their families, and turning to domestic violence agencies and reaching out for help in however it feels comfortable and safe for them. What I will say is that more and more community-based agencies, including faith-based organizations, have more training related to intimate partner violence and have more potential services and interventions available to them. I will also say that because of the pandemic, organizations have become more creative in the services that they've offered. And so while traditional domestic violence shelters per se might not be appropriate because of social distancing protocols, many agencies have and can offer other forms of emergency shelter intervention in the form of hotels or long stay apartments. And so I would encourage individuals who are experiencing intimate partner violence to look for local agencies, local resources, and reach out for help.
Margot Lindauer is the director of the Domestic Violence Institute at Northeastern University School of Law. Margot, thanks so much.
Thank you.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
Amber Ruffin has been a Black writer in mostly white spaces for much of her career. But her success has led to opportunities to make her own spaces and make them as Black as she wants.
Nothing feels better than being like, which Babyface song? Not that one, the other one. It's the feeling of writing without weights.
I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America for a conversation with comedian Amber Ruffin. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hinton, 0 for 7 with a pick. There's his first NFL completion, and it's Noah Fant, and it's good for a first down. I feel like somebody should grab that ball right there and make sure you save that.
During an NFL game this Sunday, the Denver Broncos started wide receiver Kendall Hinton at quarterback, but Hinton hadn't played the position since college, and that decision was made after Jeff Driscoll, one of the team's backup quarterbacks, tested positive for COVID-19 just last week. The rest of the Broncos quarterbacks had all been in close contact with Driscoll and are now forced to isolate. Meanwhile, the Baltimore Ravens are dealing with a major outbreak. So far, 18 Ravens players have tested positive, forcing the team to repeatedly delay a game initially scheduled for last Thursday. And while coronavirus cases continue to rise across the country, multiple teams are continuing to allow thousands of fans into the stands for their games. So even as the NFL is forging ahead with the season, it's looking increasingly risky from a public health standpoint. Joining me now is Lindsay Jones, a senior writer for The Athletic covering the NFL. Lindsay, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first of all, there are fans in the stands?
At some NFL stadiums. And some of the NFL stadiums had actually opened up to allow a limited number of fans at some point in the season, whether that was September, October, even into November. And now those stadiums have since gone back to having empty stadiums because of local and state orders. But there are some places, most notably in Dallas, where the Cowboys have allowed about 30,000 fans in their stadium. And, you know, we were dealing with coronavirus outbreaks around the country within the NFL, but the Cowboys had about a third of their stadium full.
How do the Cowboys justify doing that? Because that is a public health risk. I mean, large gatherings have been banned across the country. There are people who are working in these stadiums. So what is the risk that the NFL is taking, particularly the Cowboys, in doing that?
Yeah, it is a significant risk. And they are largely relying on whatever the ordinances are in their states and in their counties and in their cities. But the stadiums that are closed, I don't think the owners and team management are doing that out of the goodness of their hearts or out of the concern for public health around the country. They're doing it because whoever it is that's in charge and making these ordinances says you're not allowed to have these large gatherings in your stadiums. So in Texas, they're allowed to have a gathering of up to that size. And, you know, it's not like they're in massive groups. I mean, it doesn't look like a regular stadium. They're in these pods and, you know, you're supposed to have tickets only with your household. Masks are supposed to be worn at all times, but there are significant questions about how closely those are followed, if tickets are being sold, and what the contact tracing is like if there were to be an outbreak within one of these groups that started at an NFL stadium.
Lindsay, what are the protocols that the teams themselves are taking, if any, to prevent spread? Are they quarantining? Are they in a bubble themselves?
So the NFL is not operating within a bubble, not like the, you know, the NBA and the NHL had their bubbles this summer. And those were basically true bubbles where everybody was quarantined before, tested once they got inside. The NFL is not doing this. It was never really on the table logistically. The idea of doing an NFL bubble where there's more than 2,000 players, the scope, the size of the facilities, all of these things, and the length of time too, it was just never on the table for the NFL. So they tried to create these, they called it virtual bubbles, but it was never a bubble. So the NFL has been kind of existing the same way that the rest of us are, where we've been watching as cases have been surging around the country, cases are coming in from outside of their buildings. And so what the NFL's goal is to catch new infections as soon as they happen and not allow them to spread within the team, and then certainly not to another team. And largely, this process has worked. There was an outbreak within the Tennessee Titans organization late September, early October, after which the NFL changed some of its protocols, tightened a lot of their protocols, and really focused on this contact tracing that included a mandatory 5-day isolation period for anybody who was determined to be a high-risk close contact. And that largely held, and the NFL didn't have to postpone any games from about week 5 until this last week, when there was this new outbreak within the Baltimore Ravens organization, which did not just affect players. It's believed that it actually started, at least spread rapidly, when there was a coach who failed to follow protocols, and that really allowed it to spread within the building. And now the Ravens game against the Steelers has been postponed from Thanksgiving to Sunday to Monday, and now to Wednesday night.
Lindsay, the Denver Broncos quarterbacks have been felled by the coronavirus. And what do we know about where that stands?
So this was one of the wildest situations. And I think when we look back, whenever we get on the other side of this pandemic and the NFL can look back on how this season played out in 2020, what happened with the Denver Broncos is going to be one of the most bizarre situations. So what happened last week was that all 4 of the quarterbacks decided to come in on their off day on Tuesday afternoon and get together to watch film. And they were together for about 2 hours in a large-ish meeting room. And during that time, they were eating lunch together, they were watching film, and they were lax about wearing their masks. They were also not wearing their contact tracing devices that players and staff are all required to wear whenever they're inside a team facility. So you fast forward 48 hours, one of those quarterbacks tests positive. His test that he took Wednesday came back positive on Thursday morning. So they begin the contact tracing process. And the other 3 quarterbacks were not forthright about saying, oh, yes, we were together, we weren't wearing our masks. So they were initially cleared. It was initially said, okay, well, they weren't high-risk close contacts. You guys will be able to play. They got a tip. The NFL, the Broncos got a tip that the Broncos, these quarterbacks were probably not exactly forthcoming about how much exposure and contact they had to the one who had tested positive. And by Saturday afternoon, all of the other quarterbacks were ruled ineligible. So this left the Broncos scrambling. They had about 24 hours to kick off with their game against the New Orleans Saints, and they had to figure out how they were going to play. The NFL denied their request to push the game back 1 or 2 days, which would have either allowed them 1 day of practice with a practice squad wide receiver turned quarterback, or if it could have been pushed back 2 days, then their starting quarterback, Drew Lock, would have been available. The NFL said, no, we're not moving games because of competitive roster reasons. You guys are going to have to figure this out. And really what happened was a game against the New Orleans Saints where the Broncos had no chance. This kid, Kendall Hinton, he was a quarterback at Wake Forest several years ago, converted to wide receiver for the last couple years of his college career. And he was really the only person the Broncos had on their roster who had actually played quarterback in any sense. So they called him up. It was his first NFL action. And it didn't go great for anybody. And the Broncos lost 31-3.
The league has also issued fines against multiple teams for violating COVID-19 protocols. Lindsay, how effective have those fines actually been given the outbreaks that we're seeing?
Well, I mean, the NFL is not wanting to punish teams. They made it clear from the outset when NFL ownership, NFL executives, and the NFL Players Association agreed to all of these rules and these accountability measures where fines could be levied against individuals, against teams, with escalating penalties that include potentially the loss of draft picks or forfeiting of games. That's not the end goal. They don't want to punish teams this way. But the reality is that several teams have repeatedly violated protocols, and that includes the Las Vegas Raiders, who have had multiple breakdowns of COVID protocols, from having unauthorized person in their locker room to mask protocols to, you know, they have had well over 20 players placed on the COVID reserve list. They had to isolate their entire offensive line for a week. They had to isolate their entire defensive, almost their entire defensive starting lineup for a week because of kind of these lapses in the protocols. The New Orleans Saints have also been fined multiple times individually with their head coach, Sean Payton, and then towards the organization. So the fact that you're seeing the same organizations fined multiple times shows that maybe it's not working everywhere, that these penalties are not quite enough to get through if you don't want to buy in, if you're not understanding why the NFL is putting these strict protocols or these mask requirements in place.
What does this mean for the next couple of weeks of play, Lindsay, both for a public health standpoint, but also for the players on the field?
Yeah, it's really hard to predict how this last month of the season is going to go, because the last, you know, 10 days or so have been so full of chaos where, you know, the NFL had kind of gotten back into this rhythm of there would be positive cases. These players would be isolated. Other players would be cleared in time to play. So you kind of got lulled back into this sense that they were going to finish this on time. This last week has been so crazy that it's really hard to imagine that there aren't going to be continued disruptions, that we're not going to see more situations like we saw this week with the Ravens or with the Broncos, where teams are really going to be scrambling and the NFL is going to be scrambling to figure out how they're going to get all these games played and played on time. But what we know through the NFL's words and certainly through their actions over the entire course of this pandemic, really dating back to March, where they decided they were going to continue conducting their business as usual on schedule, with some modifications, but they weren't going to postpone things. They weren't going to alter their schedule, is that they're going to do everything they possibly can to get this 256-game regular season completed in this 17-game framework, which would wrap up right around New Year's. They do have the option of pushing the regular season back a week, rescheduling games if necessary into, they call it the week 18 option, which would then delay the start of the postseason. But up to now, they've shown that they are extremely reluctant to trigger that option, because if they didn't do it with that Steelers-Ravens game that has now already been moved from Thanksgiving to Wednesday afternoon, it's hard to see another situation where they're going to do that until they have absolutely no other options.
Lindsay Jones is a senior writer for The Athletic covering the NFL. Lindsay, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Throughout this pandemic, many of us have spent more time at home than we likely ever have before. And for pet owners, that's meant more time with your favorite animal companion.
This is Doris from Greenville, South Carolina. We love them the same now as before the pandemic. But I think our dogs are thinking, yay, the humans are always home.
This is Cindy. I'm in St. Louis, and my dogs are probably the reason I am sane through all of the politics and the pandemic. My husband's great company, but he talks politics and pandemic all the time.
Hi, this is Sage from Jefferson Township, New Jersey. My pets are driving me crazy. They have not brought me any comfort whatsoever. In fact, they're making my virtual teaching much harder because they don't shut up.
This is Ed from Portland, Oregon. All the usual benefits apply, a furry companion, but best of all, she's an automatic alarm telling me when UPS or FedEx packages have arrived. No worries about someone stealing a package before I get to it. Ha ha. Woof woof.
Thanks so much for those calls, listeners. You gave us a lot, so keep calling us at 877-869-8253 to share more of your pet stories. With vaccines on the horizon, though, a return to normalcy feels like it could be in sight. But going back to the office and to some of our pre-pandemic routines means pets will have to adjust to no longer having their humans around all the time. Joining me now to talk about this is Clive Wynn, the director of the Canine Science Collaboratory at Arizona State University and the author of Dog is Love, Why and How Your Dog Loves You. Clive, thanks for being with us.
Tanzina, great to be with you.
Clive, let's talk about how the pandemic is affecting pets here. I mean, are our pets aware that things are different in 2020?
Oh, I think so, very much so, Tanzina. I think it's very apparent to our pets that, as your caller said, you know, we're there all the time. This is the new normal, has been for 9 months, will be for some time to come. And I think by and large, I mean, there are exceptions. Your calls, I thought, were an interesting sample. I mean, I think for most people and most pets, this is one of those small silver linings of the strange times that we're living through at the moment.
What about the pets themselves? And I'm thinking here about how a lot of pets may not have had opportunities to connect with other pets or other humans outside of their owners during this period. Will it be hard for pets to adapt to other humans as we begin to sort of connect more? Or have pet owners been doing a good job, I guess here specifically dog owners, about getting their pets out and about?
So I think that what we've seen in the pandemic is that people and their pets have bonded more strongly because they're spending more time together. But there is this issue that, you know, we, like our pets, have been seeing fewer other people. And I think there might be a problem that there will at least be some pets that are going to be more nervous around strangers, that are going to have more difficulty, like we're talking about walking dogs at a dog park, they might have more difficulty interacting with other dogs. Those are skills that we all have to practice, and we and our dogs have probably lost some of the knack of interacting with strangers.
We know that during the pandemic, there are folks who are taking more comfort in the pets they already have. And then there are those who adopted new pets to bring home for some comfort. What should people consider before adopting a pet?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'm not going to say that it worries me that people are adopting pets during the pandemic, because I understand why they're doing it. But I think the same rules apply during the pandemic as apply at any other time. And that is, when people ask me about getting particularly a dog, I always check with them to make sure that they have a dog-shaped space in their lives. Because our dogs need things from us. They need our company. They need opportunities to exercise. And a lot of people, you know, I'm a university professor, so I have a lot of young people ask me about getting a pet. And I sit them down and I ask them about their lifestyle. What do they do? Well, these students here at Arizona State, they work hard and then they play hard, you know, and so they're not actually home very much at the time that they could actually be giving quality time to a dog or another pet. And so I usually try and, in that case, try and talk people out of getting a pet. And the danger in the pandemic is that during these exceptional circumstances where we're all stuck at home all day, every day, in this exceptional time, it might look like we can easily fit a pet into our lives. And the real danger is, well, what happens when we go back to normal? And you've got to be confident that normal life has a pet-shaped space in it if you're going to get a pet. It's not enough to be able to give your pet a good life for what it looks like it'll be a year, right? It looks like this pandemic experience will be about 12 months. And it's not enough because hopefully your dog, your cat, your whatever is going to live a lot longer than just this 1 year. You're going to have another decade or more afterwards when you need to find some way to live a rich life together with your pet.
And if you can own. Yeah. And Clive, one of the things that we're noticing is that some pets might start to get very used to having us home during the pandemic. And so what should pet owners be looking for in terms of ways to determine whether or not their pet will have a hard time adapting once their humans start leaving the house more often?
Well, Tanzina, it's going to be difficult to predict in advance. I mean, it might be noticeable that a pet is exceptionally clingy when we're home all day. But until we start going back to work and leaving the house without them, we're really not going to know what's going to happen. It's going to be unpredictable. The crucial thing is that we try and do the best we can so that we're not suddenly going up to the edge of a cliff and jumping off, confronting the animal with a change in its lifestyle, which is just so radical and so shocking and so unexpected that the animal is sure to be seriously distressed. But instead, we try and make this a gradual slope, and we try and give our animals a chance, baby steps, to get used to how life is changing. Meaning that we go out sometimes, even though at the moment, you know, we don't need to be going to work or whatever. I mean, I hardly ever go out that I couldn't be taking my dog with. But yeah, we're going to need to do that. We're going to need to run some errands without the dog, go for some walks without the dog, and just get the animal used to, hey, you know, my human can go away, but my human will come back. It's okay. It's a natural part of life, this being left alone. It's not. It doesn't mean the world has ended.
What about the humans who might have a hard time? The flip side of this is leaving their pets home. How should owners feel about their own separation anxiety or even guilt about leaving their pets home?
Well, Tanzina, the exact same way. You know, let's give ourselves the same baby steps. I mean, this seems, I advise people to do this, and yet it feels so crazy I can't bring myself to do it. And that is just go for a walk without the dog. I mean, that feels like a mad thing to do, but that's what we need to do to get ourselves and them used to separation.
You heard it here first. Clive Wynn is a psychology professor and director of the Canine Science Collaboratory at Arizona State University, and also the author of Dog is Love, Why and How Your Dog Loves You. Clive, thanks so much for being with us.
Tanzina, it was a real pleasure. Thank you.
My name is Mercedes, and I'm calling from Orange County, California. Just wanted to let you know that during this pandemic, my dog, Lennon, keeps me sane now more than ever. Couldn't get through this without him.
Hi, this is Kevin from Dallas, Texas. My cat, Benjamin, is a lovable and affectionate little fella. I've depended on him as someone to talk to, or at, and to provide some physical affection when it's unsafe to be close to other human beings. I've always been attached to my pets, but I love this little critter now more than ever.
Stephanie from Blissfield, Michigan. I began the pandemic with a dog I inherited kind of half-time from my partner's previous relationship, and secretly, I hated him. Many months later, this doggy rarely leaves my side, and I think I might wither away to nothing without our morning snuggle.
This is Mia from Bridgeport, Connecticut. I have divorced and moved during this pandemic, and I know I've spoiled my two cats more because of everything that's going on. New toys, new bedding, and more. They've become more affectionate with me since I'm working from home now. I do worry about how they'll react when I go back to the office.
And that's our show for today, everyone. You can always call us with anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.